17, United States versus Harrison, 17-6119. And counsel, we're ready when you are.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kathleen Shen, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Shondell Harrison. We're here because Mr. Harrison's ACCA sentence is illegal. When that sentence was first imposed in 2011, the district court found that his two prior convictions for Oklahoma domestic abuse, assault, and battery qualified as violent felonies by relying on the residual clause. Now that the residual clause has been held unconstitutional, those convictions no longer constitute violent felonies, and the ACCA doesn't apply.
If we could tell from the sentencing record that the sentencing court relied on both the residual clause and the elements clause, would you agree that your client would not prevail?
We don't have to reach that question here because it's not clear from the record that that's what the district court is doing. While the district court heard arguments regarding both clauses, he never actually says which one he's relying upon, and there's actually several reasons to think that he didn't rely on the force clause. First, Mr. Harrison actually raised the objection to the force clause regarding violent force versus touching. The government never countered that objection, and that all makes sense in light of the relevant background legal environment, which clearly shows that the conviction couldn't have qualified under the force clause.
The court does refer to the elements of the crime in its ruling, and it quotes from both the elements clause and the residual clause as it's announcing the sentence.
Yes.
Wouldn't the better reading of this be that the court relied on both?
No, Your Honor.
And why not?
To go through one by one, first, with respect to his reference to the elements of the crime, that really doesn't narrow things down at all. If he had relied on the residual clause, he would have just as well had to look to the elements of the crime in order to tell whether it qualified. Second, the fact that he cites both of the clauses also, I don't think, narrows things down at all because, that's the whole ACCA, Section 924E, 1, 2. What was the third part?
Well, the court specifically says in terms of an analysis of the elements of the crime.
Oh, yes. So as I said, that doesn't actually narrow things down because the residual clause also required that analysis. And then just to go back to the sentencing record, I think the fact that the government doesn't object to the Mr. Harrison's argument that the force clause couldn't apply because the convictions only require touching actually suggests that the district court did rely on the residual clause. As the government said, whether or not this is a violent, this crime requires violent force, it would qualify under the residual clause. And that is the analysis that makes the most sense given the background legal environment. Just a month before Mr. Harrison was sentenced, this court plainly held in Smith that Oklahoma assault and battery doesn't require violent force and therefore doesn't constitute a violent felony under the force clause, but could under the residual clause. So given this...
It's pretty clear the district court wasn't aware of that case, but that doesn't really matter to our analysis, does it? Or does it?
Well,
because the district court was considering both clauses, clearly seemed to be contemplating both, so it seems to me could not have been aware of the Smith case, and it was pretty recent at that point. Does that matter?
I don't think it matters because under Snyder, if the record's not clear, then we just look to the background legal environment. As this court said in Snyder, while that we characterize this as a factual finding, it's primarily one that rests on legal questions, right? And so given that you can't clearly say from the record that he relied on the residual clause, we look to the background legal environment.
And we stop looking at the underlying record at that point. It doesn't play into the legal analysis at that point, or
that's
what the
right.
relevant legal background was, I guess, is
yes.
what you're saying, yeah. And plus, the trial judge is presumed to know the law, I suppose.
Yeah, we presume the trial judges know mm-hmm. the law. And I would, point out that even though the defense counsel didn't cite Smith by name, he did cite the legal principle articulated in Smith by saying, hey, this conviction doesn't require violence, it only requires touching.
Mm-hmm.
And so given this background legal environment, we can say that it's more likely than not that the trial court relied on the residual clause and that the sentence therefore is infected with Johnson error. So then we would proceed to the second step of the analysis and ask, was that error harmless? And here it wasn't harmless Without the residual clause, there could be no ACCA sentence. In other words, the district court was wrong to say that these convictions continue to qualify as violent felonies under the force clause. I mean, as we've been discussing, that's contrary to this court's decision in Smith, which plainly holds that Oklahoma assault and battery doesn't require violent force and therefore doesn't constitute a violent felony under the force clause. And that follows directly from the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Steele versus State, where the state's highest criminal court held in a reasoned published decision that Oklahoma assault and battery doesn't require violent force because it follows the common law and therefore can be satisfied with just the slightest touching.
Does it change if we include assault in addition to battery?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. First, you know, I just point out Steele actually does concern an assault and battery conviction. It's for that reason that this court has repeatedly held that Oklahoma, you know, quote, assault and battery convictions don't satisfy the violent or don't constitute violent felonies under the force clause. Also, you know, the common law principles articulated in Steele tell us that assault is a lesser included offense of battery and that neither of those crimes require more than the slightest touching in order to sustain a conviction. So whether or not we consider this crime to be simply battery or, you know, assault and battery, it doesn't require violent force and doesn't satisfy the force clause. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time.
There don't appear to be any.
Thank you.
Excuse me. May it please the court, Stephen Kreger on behalf of the United States. Mr. Harrison is not entitled to 2255 relief for two reasons. First, he has failed to show, based on a preponderance of the evidence standard, that the district court relied solely on the residual clause. Second, he fails to show that under current law, domestic abuse, assault and battery is no longer a violent felony under the elements clause.
Let me focus you on your first point. If the record is ambiguous, then who prevails?
If the record is completely ambiguous, then the government would prevail because the defendant bears the burden of showing that it's more likely than not.
And yet we have case law that says the record has to unambiguously indicate that the court relied on a clause other than the residual clause. How do we make sense of that?
The question, first of all, I would suggest that I'm assuming you're talking about Snyder, and Snyder, what Snyder says is if the record's ambiguous, you look to the background legal environment. If that would be ambiguous, then the defendant just could not carry his burden.
Right, but I'm talking not the background legal environment, but let's say I look at what the court said at sentencing, and I can't tell for sure what the sentencing court relied on here. How does that cut?
Well, Your Honor, one thing that I would suggest, I think the background legal environment can be instructed by what the district court says, because ultimately this is a question of fact. What did the district court say at the time? Now, if the district court says nothing, then obviously there's nothing to inform. There's nothing that can add, but here the district court did say something. It said something because the defendant actually raised this issue. Mr. Harrison points to the Smith case, but Smith specifically looked at police officers. And this court.
Why does that make any difference? Why does the victim make any difference with respect to this analysis?
Because a police officer, one, is typically armed, there is a powder keg, as this court described in Smith and in prior cases leading up to Smith. There's no indication, there was no explanation prior to sentencing in this case that a domestic abuse would have the same powder keg type experience or powder keg type background. In addition to that, Smith did not specifically address just assault and battery. It addressed battery on a police officer, which would get into more of the merits question about assault. But looking strictly at the jurisdiction, to go back to the background legal environment and why I think that plays into what the court said, the background legal environment here was James. It was Sykes. And what the court said, it wasn't just some amorphous test that if it doesn't fall under the elements clause, then it must fall under the residual clause. The Supreme Court had laid out perhaps multiple tests. In Begay, it had laid out purposeful, violent, aggressive. In James and Sykes, it said you look at not just the elements, but you look at the ordinary case, and how does the ordinary case compare to the enumerated offense clause? And there was no discussion anywhere in the record about Sykes, about James, about comparison to the enumerated offense clause. There was an objection to the PSR. There was the probation office saying it comes under the elements clause. Then at sentencing, you have the government adopting what the probation officer said. And thus, I would dispute what my opponent suggested, that the government didn't rely on the elements clause. It said, to the extent there's a question, there's also the residual clause. But there was no suggestion on how the residual clause would be satisfied. And then finally, in response in its holding, the court said that it had, quote, no trouble at all concluding that these offenses, these domestic abuse offenses committed by this defendant, do fall within Section 924E as a definitional matter. This goes back to what the government was suggesting. As a definitional matter, it might not fall within the elements clause. Here, the court said it has as a definitional matter. It does as a definitional matter in terms of an analysis of the elements.
Well, right, but as the appellant is saying here, that doesn't really mean anything, because the residual clause would have required, I mean, they would have had to do the same categorical analysis and look at the elements. So why does that mean anything in terms of what the court ultimately decided, where this came within, which clause it came to?
Because what the court required, as far as the residual clause goes, is an ordinary case analysis. And that's what the court ultimately said in Johnson and in DiMaia and in Welch.
Which examined the elements.
Correct, but the ultimate question is not
analysis of the elements of the crime, which is what he said.
And how those ultimately end up in the ordinary case. Just because it might not fall within the elements, you look to what the ordinary case is and compare, as far as the residual clause went at the time, you compare the risk of force in the ordinary case to the risk of force or the risk of injury in an enumerated offense case. Mm-hmm. And there was no discussion about what the analogous enumerated offense was.
Well, but it's still ambiguous. We don't really know, do we? There's not enough there to say.
At most, most favorable to the defendant, what we have here is the district court relying on both. And even if the district court relied on both, as the First Circuit explained in DeMott, the 11th Circuit explained in Beeman, cases this court adopted in the United States v. Washington, the defendant bears the burden not only of showing by preponderance of the evidence that the district court could have relied on the residual clause, but it in fact relied solely on the residual clause. And the defendant has not met that burden here in light of the record and in light of the background legal environment. But even if this court were to conclude that the defendant has met his burden.
Well, before you move on to that, I'm sorry. I just have to explore what you mean by both. I mean, essentially, are you arguing that if you read the record, you will come to the conclusion that the judge relied both as independent bases? Is that what you're arguing? And therefore, even if you knock out residual, the other one stands?
That's my secondary argument, Your Honor. My first argument is I would suggest the record is fairly clear that all of the thrust was going towards the elements clause. The government brought up this second. Excuse me.
No, that's fine. I mean, your first argument is that I read this as the court relying on the elements clause.
Correct.
My second argument is the court relied on both. So if you knock out the residual clause, you still have the elements clause.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. But even if the court were to conclude that the defendant has met his burden and showed that it was more likely than not the court relied on the residual clause, he still fails, he's still not entitled to relief because domestic abuse, assault and battery, is a violent felony. Excuse me. Title 21, Section 644C criminalizes assault and battery. The legislature has defined what assault and battery is, and the Court of Criminal Appeals, as early as the Parks v. State case, explained that assault and battery necessarily includes an assault. The Oklahoma legislature in Title 21, Section 641, defined an assault as the unlawful and willful attempt or offer with force or violence to do a corporal hurt. The legislature did not define what a corporal hurt was, but Title 25, Section 1 of the Oklahoma statutes tells courts to give an undefined term, not its common law meaning, but the plain and ordinary meaning. The Court of Criminal Appeals, as the district court did in this case, has interpreted that as meaning the dictionary definition. Looking at the dictionary, corporal means of the body, hurt means pain or injury. This is confirmed by other cases by the Court of Criminal Appeals. For example, in Parks, again, it says an assault requires an attempt to injure. It becomes an assault and battery when that attempt to injure culminates in a battery, but it still requires an assault and battery still requires an attempt to injure. It said so in Burleson v. Saffel, where it said that an assault requires an attempt to injure. It also said so in Tyner v. United States. While the statute at issue in Tyner, because it was a territorial statute, did not involve the term corporal hurt, it does influence and it does affect the interpretation of the phrase corporal hurt because it was decided 1 year before the statute was enacted. And in Tyner, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that the phrase corporal hurt is not substantially different than the term violent injury. Because an assault requires an attempt to injure, and because an assault and battery requires an assault, then an assault and battery must require an attempt to injure. And if there is an attempt to injure, that would satisfy 924E2B1, which makes something a violent felony if it has as an element the attempted or threatened use of physical force. Now, opposing counsel had referenced Steele v. State, and while Steele was an assault and battery case, I would suggest this court needs to pay attention to the precise language the Steele court used. Steele did not say an assault and battery, or that an assault is satisfied by the slightest touching or the attempted slightest touching. What Steele said is that the force, quote, the force or violence element of battery can be satisfied by the slightest touching. And it's that force or violence language, not the corporal hurt language, that Steele was addressing.
It's hard to imagine that the force necessary is different for an assault than a battery when an assault culminates in a battery. If it's really an unrealized battery when you assault someone, isn't it?
Your Honor, in light of the statutes, I would disagree with that. The legislature could have defined an assault as simply an attempt or offer to do force or violence, or an attempt or offer of force or violence to another person. It included the words to do a corporal hurt there. I think Judge Friant, in the order on appeal, gave a perfectly reasonable explanation. It's an explanation the Court of Criminal Appeals used, I believe, in Parks and Minix, where it's as if someone is to strike you with a club or hit you with a fist, force that would be capable of causing pain or injury, force that would result in a corporal hurt if it was realized in its fullest extent, but they were to be stopped. And so if a person throws a slug, tries to hit somebody, and is prevented from doing so, that would still be an assault. If they graze them and barely touch them, that might be an assault and battery, but that still was an attempt to use for violent physical force. And I would suggest that at the end of the day, the Oklahoma cases bear this out. Even if this court were to accept the defendant's argument with regard to Steele, this court recently in United States v. Garcia explained that what the court does is more important than what the court says. Every case that addresses assault and battery in any form in Oklahoma, which the Court of Criminal Appeals has affirmed, has required a hitting, a grabbing, something along those lines. And what this court said in Garcia, adopting Justice Scalia's concurrence in Castleman, is that grabbing, hitting, punching, things like that constitute violent physical force.
And thus, so ignore what they say and pay attention to what the facts are?
Well, what Garcia, not in this specific case, but what Garcia did, the New Mexico robbery case, there were some Court of Appeals opinions that said pretty much the exact same thing. The amount of force sufficient or required for robbery was immaterial. And what this court said is, but when we look at how New Mexico actually applies the statute, it differentiates between actual violent force and nonviolent force. At the end of the day, what the defendant has asked this court to do essentially is say that it would be a felony violent, a felony domestic abuse for kids sitting in the back seat who live together on a long road trip, say, I'm going to touch you, tap. That's a crime, according to the defendant. And there is nothing in the record in Oklahoma law that would suggest that would be a crime of domestic abuse, assault, and battery. The government would ask this court, if it reaches the merits question, not to apply judicial imagination, but instead to look at what the cases say and to apply a reasonable interpretation of Oklahoma law. If there are no further questions, thank you.
I'd just like to respond to a few of the points made by the government's counsel. First, you know, I think in this context, while the record's not silent, it is ambiguous, and for purposes of Snyder, that lack of clarity is sufficient to get us to the background legal environment. And second, you know, he commented on the fact that the conviction Smith involved an assault and battery on a police officer. You know, I don't think that makes a difference here because the most important thing about Smith is it clearly precludes the district court from relying on the force clause, leaving the residual clause as the only option. To go to the corporal hurt argument, so the legislature's use of the phrase corporal hurt doesn't supersede Steele, and it can't. First, you know, that statutory definition precedes Steele, and so if there was any merit to the government's argument, then Steele would have come out a different way, but it doesn't. And then, again, you know, Steele clearly states that Oklahoma follows the common law with assault and battery, and that's actually consistent with the statutory definition. As this court recognized in Mason, at the common law, the phrase corporal hurt included the merest touching. And, you know, it's also consistent, again, I mean, this is all in the briefs, but the Oklahoma jury instructions define force to mean just the slightest touching for assault as well as battery. Going to the point about this court's decision in Garcia and whether there's a realistic probability that the statute could be applied to cover nonviolent force, Garcia is distinguishable for a number of reasons. Most importantly, Steele is unequivocal in holding that you don't need violence in order to have a conviction for Oklahoma assault and battery. And that's why this court has repeatedly held that Oklahoma assault and battery convictions don't satisfy the force clause. The other thing that's really important to note is that unlike with the New Mexico robbery conviction at issue in Garcia, there aren't any lower court convictions or decisions vacating convictions for lack of force. So there's really no basis for concluding that a court would vacate a domestic violence conviction for lack of force. And as this court said in Mason, even if most cases do in fact involve force, that doesn't mean it satisfies the force clause. And the last point is just, you know, regarding the Oklahoma law's decision to cover nonviolent force. I mean, as the Supreme Court recognized in Castleman, there's actually a reason that in the domestic violence context, statutes are written broadly in order to cover nonviolent force, and that's because legislatures have sometimes made the judgment that this is a particularly harmful context in which nonviolent force should be criminalized as well as violent force. And so I think with all that, I just want to conclude by saying, you know, Johnson error occurred in this case. The error wasn't harmless. And I'd ask that you reverse the district court, vacate Mr. Harrison's sentence, and remand for resentencing without application of the Armed Career Criminal Act. Thank you.
Thank you.